Alrighty. Good morning, everyone. My name is Andrew Charlton. I'm from a company called Enabling. We're a Microsoft partner that has been working in the Microsoft Dynamics space, particularly with CRM and NAV, for probably the best part of 10 years now. Me personally, I've been implementing ERP type solutions for, I hate to admit it, probably the better part of 20 years. Thanks for coming along to my session today. Just a quick show of hands, how many people are partner side implementers? Yeah? Great. And how many people are what we would call customer side? All righty. Just to see who's paying attention, how many of you guys are winners? Okay. All righty. Today's session really is, I guess, about the lessons we've learned in the implementation of particularly Microsoft Dynamics CRM, probably over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. They're really key, the three key things that we have that we've learned, I guess, in the context, I guess, of a bunch of other stuff. Probably what I'd like to do is in the course of today's session, cut through and just really give you some sort of context for the rest of my discussion. So what I call a field of play, what sort of environments we're working in, what components are we talking about, and then I'll go into the lessons learned. I guess for the technically minded people, there's a one component that is strictly technical. I guess the balance of it is more around the management of people. Okay. I guess what I'm trying to do is teach, I guess, what I call the toughest and probably the most painful lessons that we've learned. And hopefully this is something that you can take away with you, take back to your own businesses and own environments, and with a bit of luck, use to your advantage. Okay. So as I said earlier, we started implementing CRM a few years ago. We've been implementing other CRM applications from some of the well-known vendors for a number of years. And the initial impressions when we looked at the environment, we were familiar with the Microsoft space. We were familiar with the tools in terms of the .NET and the C# for development. And our initial impression was, yeah, this should be pretty straightforward. It won't take us long. We've got a bunch of smart developers, and we'll just whack them in there, and within a few weeks, we'll start getting results. We were right on at least one count, okay, and that was we did start getting results very shortly. Okay, the fact that a lot of it in the initial stages didn't really go our way was, in part why I'm talking to you today. A couple of the other things that we did, and I should imagine many of your businesses would be like this, and it's also a fairly typical in terms of the broader scope of project management, and that is we did all our requirements up front, which we still do. We typically write this up in what we call a requirements analysis and functional spec. In many instances, we'd palm this off to the developer, and we'd say, well, here you go. Come back in a few weeks' time when you've got something to show us, and we'll take it from there. So that was something we've had to review. In terms of our implementation methodologies, over the years, I've personally been involved in the development of methodologies. There are a large number of them out there in the market. I guess the difficulty with many of these things is finding out the bits that work for you as an organization and the bits that are applicable for a particular client, okay, or any one particular situation. The bits I'm doing are talking about today are really what I call the distilled components of the methodology we've used. The key thing from us is really to keep it simple on two counts. One is that you want your own guys to be able to follow this with relative ease, and it needs to be unambiguous. And on the flip side, you need the customers to be able to follow it easily as well. And you don't want to have to find yourself having to explain vastly difficult methodologies over and over again. Okay, so the scenario in terms of how we got to talk about this, we recently implemented a 250 user CRM site with a national rollout right across across all the states. We've got users operating both in the metro areas as well as the regional areas. They're highly mobile, and as a result of that, when it comes to the technology used to access CRM on the fly, there obviously there's always questions asked about, you know, what worked really well and what sort of devices would you use in that particular space. I guess so often what happens in many of these implementations, I guess the reason why you're implementing is that sometimes you know, the customer might have had a pleasant experience and they've really just outgrown the tools. Sometimes experience may not have been too pleasant, but nonetheless is that people would have had some prior experience of implementation. And as a result of that, what we often find is that users are typically wary, and building their confidence is a key component often of what we have to do. You need to get the customer side people on side and have them believing in what you're able to do, and then also showing that you can consistently deliver. In this particular instance as well, is that we also had a legacy-based a SQL ERP solution. And I guess what's important is that end-to-end, all the existing infrastructure, okay, was all Microsoft. Okay, you know, for the most, all the servers, the databases, etc., all based around that technology, which is a key thing. Okay. Looking, I guess, at why implementations in this particular space, or in fact many implementations, go awry, one of the key things we found, and this is something that we needed to overcome, is that you have an expectation that's set on the user side as to what they're going to experience when they start to use the application, both in terms of the day-to-day functionality as well as its robustness. Okay. Typically, what can happen is that there's a load delivery or a mismatched delivery in terms of what they actually get in the end. And whenever there's surprise on the user side, people are typically unhappy. And our mechanism that we needed to evolve is that how we keep these two pictures, in sync. When going through the requirements with users, people can explain any given scenario, for example, how their leads might work, or how appointments they might want appointments to work, or how a bit of marketing functioning needs to happen. And when people are working at a conceptual level, 9 times out of 10, you'll have the customer with an image that looks out here and looks like that, and you have a vendor with an image over here. They both think they're talking about the same thing, but when you physically start to translate that into screens and all that sort of stuff, often they're quite different. So a key part of what we needed to overcome in all of this was to ensure that both the customer and our developers both had exactly the same picture. Okay, we didn't want any surprises when it came to delivery. And that's really so that if there were going to be any differences, the guys were aware of that up front before you sort of got all of this stuff into production, and you're in a position to take corrective action if need be. So that really covers off, the one side is the high expectation, low delivery. A key thing is what we call a functional misfit. The guys would, developers would say, well, you wanted this to happen and here it is. But then your user would say, well, I actually need it to work like this. It doesn't require a huge amount of difference in functionality to be able to frustrate users. Okay, just in terms of, when I create an appointment, I want a whole pile of fields to say, for example, default. I want the existing appointment date to become the plus 2 days to become the new appointment date for follow-ups and that type of thing. So when it's not actually complementing the way that the user's operating, they can find it extremely frustrating, and that then leads to enormous instantaneous downgrade of the experience. Okay. So, what are our success criteria, and what are the indicators certainly for us in terms of the way that we'd rank people, users being happy? What we found is that, and this is something that's worked for us, okay, and that when we stuck to these three lessons of ours, what we found is that there was a much higher rate of user acceptance, okay. When it isn't absolutely spot on, what we're finding is probably way less than 50% of the users weren't prepared to say nice things. Okay, they weren't net, what we call net promoters. Okay, and you guys, it's what I call corridor talk. It doesn't take much of it. You know, you'll have often we're working in an environment with a lot of tradies, and the guys call it as it is. Okay, you know, excuse my French for a moment, but there's nothing like, you know, the CEO of an organization walking past Bob, who's just come out off a construction site or something like that, and he says, well, how's the new CRM system, guys? And the guy goes, well, it's up. Okay. Now, the interesting thing is that no one bothers to ever clarify what means. Okay? It's just all bad. You know, it's small things like that that we try and nip in the bud very early on in the piece. Okay. So what we have found is that by way the majority of users are way more willing to accept and talk positively about their experience when we've gone through this mechanism. Okay. The second thing is a high functional fit. Okay. Now I guess historically, the tool set you use has often been quite limiting. Now, what we find in practical terms is that when working with CRM in the Microsoft environments, there are very few practical limitations. Certainly from a technology point in terms of achieving stuff, sometimes, you know, you do need to be technically adept, but for the most part, we've been able to deliver, I'd say, almost 99% of all the functionality that users have requested. Okay. Part of scope control is that, you know, in doing requirements, is that users often can be a bit like kids in a candy store. Okay, I want this and that, and it's got to do this and launch shuttles when I press this button. Okay, part of the scope control and one of the lessons I'll talk about later is having someone to control that and set expectations as you go along. Okay, the last thing really is around meeting user expectations. Often people sort of say, well, let's aim for exceeding user expectations. That's all fine and well, I guess, but in the context of what I'm talking about here is the difficulty often we face with the concept of exceeding user expectations, that there's some stuff that's a surprise. Okay. Now, the risk in surprise is that surprise can go both ways. If there's stuff they don't know about, okay, they can go, that doesn't work for me, and then you're on the back foot. So our method really is about keeping the guys informed as to every little bit of functionality they're going to get, so that when they arrive, there's absolutely no surprises. This is a lesson I learned several years ago, I guess, with a company that did interior fit-outs for high-end corporates. Okay, their angle in the market was to take a building shell, say, for example, one of these high-rises, and if you had taken over a floor, their idea is they'd take over the fit-out of that from the concrete shell stage. Okay, so they put in all their lighting, they put in the flooring, they put in all the walls, the partitioning, all that sort of stuff. What they used to do is advise people as to where to spend their money, okay, in terms of the high impact areas, like, for example, the reception. What they also did then is they had very detailed floor layouts. People had graphic images in terms of graphic mock-ups and photographs, so they knew exactly what the carpets were going to look like, what the walls were going to look like, what the lighting impact of choosing certain things was going to be, so there were absolutely no surprises when they walked on the first day. It's exactly what they expected. Okay, and from that point of view, what it does mean is that there's a very little scope then for disappointment. Okay, so the bits we've used in these implementations, SQL Server 2008, together with Microsoft, some of the other SQL tools like SSRS as well as SSIS, and I'll talk through some of those areas in terms of how we use those. All of this is working with Exchange and Outlook. As some of you all know, that CRM works both from a web browser interface point of view with that UI as well as an Outlook UI. Okay, it's interesting, the majority of the users were working on an Outlook UI in for the most part of our projects. We've got BizTalk working in this environment as well, and what that is doing is it's linking the legacy ERP SQL application to CRM in terms of updating of things like customer information. We've got the use of InfoPath. Okay, one of the key components of this, I guess, is the acquisition of intelligence. What we spent a lot of time doing is going around to all the regional areas in each of the different states and uncovering, you know, the key things. What I like to do is gather this intelligence firsthand, okay? So that when we did presentations to people, keeping them up to date, I'd make sure I was in the room, didn't need to participate. The customer, you know, project lead on the customer side was explaining, keeping people up to date. But I'd listen to what was going on in the background, you know, as to what people found important. One of the key things was being able to capture what we call leads on the fly. Okay, so when a person is driving around through an industrial area, you know, something like Wetherill Park or Dandenong or one of those areas, they might go past and see a building name, and there might be some activity going on there, and they'll say, "Hang, that's useful information." Okay, what they're then able to do is go in via the client SharePoint portal InfoPath form, fill in all the details, and click submit. Okay, two things needed to happen from then on so that everyone in the loop was happy. One is the person submitting the information, and what the feedback we got is they like to know what had happened. You know, I gave you guys a lead. Did you drop it? Did you lose it? Weren't they interested? So what happened is that when that lead was later qualified using the standard CRM processes, there was an email sent to the person to say, "Yep, this is what happened. It was an existing customer. We know it. Thank you. Alternatively, it has progressed. And we now engage with the customer." The second thing is that for all intents and purposes, all they might have at the time that lead is put in is a company name and a suburb. Okay, so we had address validation working in here, and what that basically did is that if they put in a state code or when they put in a street name, it went off to an address validation service, came back with a number of options, inserted that. Their salespeople are allocated territories via postcodes and suburbs. So what would happen is that lead would automatically get allocated to the right person. Okay, so we spent a lot of time trying to make sure that the workflow suited the way the business needed to operate in practical terms. Okay, the second part of SharePoint was really document management. And that was, this is not work we all did ourselves. We did work with other partners, particularly partners that were experts in the BizTalk and the SharePoint space. And what they're able to do is to render SharePoint forms directly on the customer card inside CRM. Okay, so in things like projects, there's normally a lot of project information that salespeople need to collect. So the initial RFP or RFQ, tender documents together with all your submissions and all the myriad of other documents that recorded at the same time, all able to put that in against the record that it related to. Okay, so we had concepts like a single view of customer, so that when you go onto customer, you can get all related information from there. That relates both to things like sites they might be working on, documents that might relate to them, revenue details that came from the ERP system. Okay, So that we had SharePoint in there, and then on top of that, we obviously had Dynamics CRM working across the board. Now, what is good to know is this stuff all works. Okay, we had in the implementation of all these components is that inherently we're working on current versions, and it all worked. Okay. In the process of implementing, we certainly had a number of difficulties, and 9 times out of 10, we found that those related to skills. Okay, it wasn't because the products were, and I use the word that's often shonky. Okay, the stuff does hang together and it does work well. And part of this thing is understanding that you've got to get the right skills to the point of breakdown. Okay, so forgive me for this schematic. Okay. The technically adept amongst you probably say, well, possibly not exactly correct, but it's a conceptual diagram showing how all of this stuff worked. So what we had is two CRM servers. These are both virtualized. Okay, we're working with a third party load balancing device, so that you know, obviously we could keep the number of users and the performance up and correctly balanced between the two servers. BizTalk is used as an integrating tool across the organization, across more applications than just the ERP and CRM. So there were two BizTalk servers that were extracting information. From a SQL point of view, obviously all SQL database, we needed to provide sales information, okay? So for example, if you wanted to see what a customer's sales are year to date, or a customer's revenue month to date, or across each of the months, that information basically needs to be summarized by our reporting, and what happens, that's all done through SQL cubes. Okay, and what we then used is a little bit of MDX and SSIS to be able to update that information periodically onto the customer card, so that when salespeople can go onto, they could get all that relevant information. Okay, and then on top of that, we've got SharePoint and Outlook as well. Okay. In terms of the timelines, how long did all of this stuff sort of take? We spent about 2 months doing a prototype, and again, the key thing for us is that, and this you're able to do because of the how quick and easy CRM is to work with. A prototype absolutely key in terms of being able to align people's expectations. That probably took us about 2 months, and that included a roadshow to each all the different regions to keep people updated. Okay. We had a four-month development life cycle. This was pretty very intense. And again, the method that we worked certainly enabled us to do this. We had multiple developers working on the project as well. And then there was a two-month training and rollout. Okay, so why are you here? The first of the three lessons, I guess, and I've done this in reverse order, because this particular lesson kind of sets the scene for the way the rest of, and all three of these lessons are interrelated. And I guess the key thing is that if you don't set yourself up in terms of the way that you work, what ends up happening is that a lot of the other stuff is way more difficult to do, okay? So how did we come up with this concept of work like Pac-Man, okay? And the thing is, if you watch Pac-Man running around a screen, he always takes one button at a time, okay? And Pac-Man's able to move pretty quickly, provided he always moves in a straight line. So the idea really is that we break up the work into what we call bite-sized chunks. What's the best way to eat an elephant? It's in bite-sized chunks. What this enables you to do is to provide any single developer with a single stream of work, but you're also able to organize the balance of the work into, you can have multiple parallel streams, so to say. So it enables multiple people for you to be able to coordinate and have multiple people working simultaneously on the same project in a coordinated fashion. Okay. The key issue is design. Many of you would have seen several iterations of this diagram. Okay, I looked at the date. You see, it's been around since 1970. Okay, this is, I think, the original, one of the original ones. Okay, and that idea really comes back to the point I made earlier, relating to on the top left-hand side, so if you look at the bottom right-hand side, that's what the customer wanted. Okay, and then you kind of see, depending on whether you're marketing or sales or engineering, all people, in terms of the same concept, would have slight variations in exactly the same thing or similar things. Okay, and our big challenges is how we go about making sure that everyone understands exactly the same thing. Okay, so the first thing that we did with, and this is fairly typical, is we went out to each of the different regions. Okay, and we stepped through, I guess, what the requirements are, what they wanted this thing to be able to do, okay? And why it's important, I guess, the key thing here, okay, is not to go to one small group or only one person within an organization when you're taking these requirements. The key thing is to get lots of feedback. What is interesting in any organization, particularly in a national organization or in offices, each office is ultimately different, okay? You'll have a CEO saying, we all work exactly the same way, okay? And time again, I have to go, no, you don't. Okay? When you sit down and you go to Queensland, they're different to the guys in Melbourne. Okay? That are different to the guys in New South Wales. Okay? Even in Sydney, the way people operate in the metro versus the west, it's different. There's different culture, different emphasis, and it's vitally important that you get your head around that and get that feedback. Okay? Likewise, when we came to do the prototyping and the feedback sessions later down the line, we got different feedback as well. Okay. All right. So the process that we basically follow is we went through a requirements gathering exercise, okay? The next thing, what we chose to do in all of this stuff is that we do all our requirements and design, okay? And the key word is and design up front, okay? And the reason being is that historically, when I spoke about earlier, is that you know, a BA goes out, they take down the requirements, they document it, and they say to the developer, here you go. What hasn't happened is the translation of those requirements into a form the actual end user wants, okay? So what we find ourselves doing, and it sometimes happened over and over again until everyone is happy, we take the requirements, we translate those requirements into a function, into a prototype screen. So in CRM, you can go and add tabs, you can put in forms, you can put in fields, you can do lookups. We really didn't, the fields weren't, they were just skins, there wasn't a lot of functionality, we talked people through the functionality. But for the most part, we went through that process often several times until everyone was kind of happy with what they saw. And this needs to happen, I guess, from our point of view in this environment for two reasons. The first time any group of people get to have a look at a CRM screen, this could be with any application, it's overwhelming. There's a bunch of stuff that comes out at them, okay? And a lot of the time, you know, they're there for the day during a requirements analysis session, and the 5 minutes that you're dashing around a screen showing them how stuff works often is just not enough time for the guys to feel comfortable, okay? And this iteration over and over again gives them the time to become more and more familiar with the application. And in this, you win two ways. One is that you're slowly building disciples, people that are going to go out and tell their colleagues that this is pretty good. And the second thing, they're gaining more comfort. The second thing is you're getting an alignment between their requirements and their expectation, okay, in terms of how you've understand it, how they understand it, and how it's actually going to work. That's continually being aligned, okay? Which basically means that there's there's very little chance, hopefully, at the end of it, of this thing not working for them. Okay. So, to what degree of detail? Now, the thing is, okay, if I go back to this side, okay, in taking requirements from users, okay, there's one thing that's completely consistent every single time, and that it will change. This morphs, okay? And the idea really is to get the requirement to the point in time where you can draw a line in the sand and you can say, that's what we're going to deliver now, okay? Now, one of the bits I'm talking about later is the people, okay? And what an important role, both from the client side and the customer side, those roles are in terms of being able to manage it and say, that's where we're going to take it to, okay? So the way we went and did this is that we would take screenshots, okay, so the guys knew exactly from our prototype, this is exactly the way that it's going to operate. And what we'd then do is basically screen by screen, field by field, go through and detail exactly what functionality these individual forms we're going to provide. Okay. Now, in terms of functional specification, the idea basically is that once you've signed that off, certainly from our point of view, we can go through and we'll cost that out. Because you're going into a fair degree of detail, people often look at the cost of something at the end of the day and they go, jeepers, why does it cost so much? Well, you can say, well, here it is. You can go through, you know, we divide this into what we call blocks of work. So each of the little Pac-Man buttons, we call those a block, okay? And each one of those have a cost associated with it. Now, from a scoping point of view, you can choose which pieces you take in or out, but nonetheless, what it does do is that it gives you a very granular idea of how much it's going to cost, okay? The second thing is that you also agree what functionality there is, okay? Now, the one thing, again, I said that is completely consistent, when we come to development, by this stage, people, again, they've had a little bit more chance to look at the product, and as a result of that, they're a little more educated, and they're starting to gain an appreciation of what the product can do, so they want to change stuff, okay? Sometimes they're minor changes, okay, sometimes the major changes. What we'll do is from the original functional specification that we've costed out, we'll put in any changes in yellow or any different color. So when we come down to the variations later down the line, we've got an area where we can agree those with the customer. And the second thing, it's very easy at a glance to see how much has changed and why suddenly something's going to take 5 days as opposed to two. Okay. So again, it's just that aligning of expectations and providing a relatively simple mechanism for people for us to be able to communicate actually what's going on deep down in the project. Okay. So, what we then do is each of these, we then, I spoke earlier, is that we break down the entire project into what we call blocks of work. Okay. On some projects, we've had as few as maybe 20 blocks of work. Okay. And in other projects, it's gone up to, up near around 180. Okay. What is a block of work? From our point of view, a block of work is any piece of work that might take no more than 2 to 5 days. Okay. How do we go about executing these blocks of work? Typically, what we'll do is we'll look to have a touch point twice a week. Okay. Sometimes it can be on a Monday and a Thursday, Monday and a Friday, as long as it's cast in stone. And as long as the developers are able to deliver an amount of work during that time frame, okay. Now, the cycle that we follow for any one given block is that we'll take the functional spec and we'll storyboard it like they do in the movies, okay. And we literally go through. And in this particular instance, it's only one tab, okay, because the functions that are on that particular tab, would take approximately two to five days to do, okay. So we'll step through exactly what happens, needs to happen from a process. So what would have happened before this point, what needs to happen after at a high level. In addition to that, we'll take some representative data and we'll say, when you put this stuff in, this is what needs to happen at the end, and we'll go through the permutations. Now, there's a lot of detail in here, okay? Now, what is important is the people that come to the briefings, what we call a sprint, okay? They need to be at least the owners of this information on the customer side, okay? You need to have the customer lead there. From a vendor side, at least the solution architect needs to be there, the person that spec'd all this up, and you need the developer. They all need to be in the room at the same time. And what we then do is that we then talk through this. Okay, and what typically happens, all right, is that there will be changes. Okay, people understand, now I know what happens. Now I'm beginning to understand what happens, what you want to have happen when all this stuff gets entered in there. We then have, and that would happen early on in the week. So we'll go through in detail, explain what needs to happen. The developer gets a chance to ask any questions, seek any clarification, and request more detail if they don't have sufficient detail. What we then do is the developer can then go away, do the work. Certainly from our point of view, what we expect when they deliver that work later on in the week is that at least all the 101 errors are gone. Okay, there are no white screens of death that pop up. It's functional. It will work exactly as described. Okay, and this is key because if that doesn't happen is that we have an erosion of confidence from the client side. Okay, because every single time you deliver faulty work or stuff that doesn't work, you get these looks of disappointment, and ultimately it starts to generate bad blood. So what is important is being able to deliver that stuff right every single time. Okay, now again, let's go back to the Pac-Man concept. Okay, and the reason why we do it in such small chunks is that what I've come to appreciate over a period of time is when it comes to development, it requires an enormous amount of energy on the part of the developers. Okay, there's a lot of stuff going on there. They really have to get themselves, they're like Picasso in some way. They really have to get themselves often into a zone and to be able to develop this quickly, and they need to have the time to do it. So what we made sure is that the guys had nothing else on their plate while they were developing that. We removed things like support calls. We removed other project work to do that, so they had the headspace to do this, okay? So at least protect the 2 or 3 days that it requires to happen. Now, in real life, there's always other stuff going on, but what we had to do is sometimes get that off to separate support people or queue it up and say, well, you're going to have 3 clear days and 1 day for support later down the line. But what we found was imperative is that they had the headspace to do that. The moment they had too much on their plate, we found that the quality would suffer. Okay, and as a result of that, you'd start to get a little bit of lag in the project. Later on in the week, so for example, on a Friday, we'd get together, again, the same team that was together when we had the start of the sprint, and we'd then have the developer talk us through and physically demonstrate all the things that worked. Okay. Now, what was really interesting, okay, and this is very important because this is a great educator from a client point of view in terms of understanding the level of detail that developers need to work to. So often what would happen, if I come back to this screen, so when people go and enter certain stuff in the screen, you'll notice things like the email address are grayed out and the contact phone number is formatted. Now, you know, it's all too often customers would sit there and they'd go, well, I assume that a product of this nature would know how to format numbers to an Australian standard. Okay, no, because it's a standard product and some of that stuff has to be coded in. And then say, oh, but I want the email, I don't want them to mess with the email address because that comes off a contact or customer record. Ah, so we'll gray that out. And what happens in the first one or two review sessions is they start to appreciate the level of detail that needs to go into the functional spec. Okay? So that when we go through the second and the third and the fourth block, they're now thinking at that level. Okay, so if the guys aren't doing that and providing that feedback, what ends up happening is that you can never finish a block in a week, okay, because there's always this lag, there's always this stuff that they're wanting to change on the back end, okay. So that was a great educator, and also what it does is push some responsibility back onto the client side to say, you're a contributor in this process too, this is ultimately your system, and you need to this help us out with doing this stuff. The responsibility on the developer side is they've got to develop that stuff working. It's got to arrive and it's got to be in place. We don't waste any time. Okay, so that's a key thing. Now, what we also find in these blocks is that very early on in the piece, for things like telephone numbers or the graying out of certain fields or making them non-editable, is that we could adopt a convention early on in the piece. So we'd say, all right, this is the type of functionality we want to see all over the place. Okay, so that was a bit of information that so developers could, you know, they need sometimes that clarity early on in the process. Okay, so what are the takeaways from this? This mechanism of doing blocks and sprints, okay, what it does enable you to do is it gives you an intense focus on one particular thing at a time, okay? And what we found is that we had a high hit rate, okay? One of the great things about breaking a project down into lots of these bite-sized chunks is that there's nothing more inspiring than success, okay? So when a customer could go to their boss, because I guess when we're doing these implementations, there's vested interest on both sides. From our side, we want to be able to do the work to get paid. On the customer side, these guys need to get this thing done. And 9 times out of 10, in fact, 100% of the time, their performance in terms of how they're evaluated internally are vested in this particular project. Okay. So the good thing is that from a customer and from our side, we're able to record success very early on in the piece, and it's continuous. The risk is typically can be contained in one particular sprint. If you're having difficulty in a particular area, contain it. You can say it's this area. Okay. What's important is that you don't allow, from our point, what we found is that it was best not to allow a developer to work on more than one sprint at any one point in time. If they didn't finish it, or if there was stuff to be clarified or sorted out or corrected, they did that first before starting the next sprint. So and what that enabled us to do is to sign it off. There's closure, that bit's done. Okay. The big win in terms of this constant gratification, certainly from it was in some respects in hindsight an expected benefit, but it was great because, you know, from our guys were continually motivated because they were getting this weekly win. And then from a customer side education point of view is that the guys were appreciating what goes into developing, and also they were seeing their functionality grow. And there was always this time to, as the stuff is allowed to change because that's life, we're able to change the stuff on the fly as we went along. Okay. So that's I guess our first key lesson. The second lesson in here is the technology. Okay, there was some stuff that we really needed to appreciate in terms of under the hood, what actually goes on in the background. Okay. Now, without going into too much detail in the background, I guess one of the things with particularly with CRM in terms of the getting this to work with other applications is we needed to give a fair, we needed to really understand or have people that really understood what goes on with Active Directory in the background, how that interacts with CRM, how that interacts with BizTalk, and what you're able to do with the tools. So certainly you need to get up, make sure that you've got all the right SPM permissions set up between the servers. Okay, that's pretty critical. You need to understand that part of our solution involved going off to the ASIC website, because what we wanted to do was validate that a customer we understood which company we're dealing with. So what we'd do is we'd put in an ABN number, and we had a call out, like a little bit of JavaScript that would go off to the ASIC website, get validate that ABN was correct, bring back an ACN, okay, we could do it either way, and bring back the registered company name of that of that particular customer. Now, in a network, the fact that that's going outside, some of that stuff, depending, there's a lot of stuff that may prevent that stuff working. So what we needed to make sure is that we had the right people from the client side, from the network, to ask and open a lot of those gateways for us. Other little things, we try to do a live price book update from a CRM quote off to the ERP system. The mechanism that we were using was literally in JavaScript underneath in a CRM form. And what we found is that in some environments, the HTTP requests weren't allowed in that particular environment. So there are a few little things that we needed to figure out along the way. With the BizTalk integration, again, this we used really just the standard tool set, okay? There were some things, I guess, in working with everyone, we really had to map out every little bit of detail in terms of how we wanted this integration to work. Okay, I worked with a couple of other integration tools in the past, and they had these inherent mechanisms for you to be able to make sure that this record in one application equaled that record in there, either via mapping of GUIDs or something along those lines. What we found is that in BizTalk, a lot of that stuff isn't there, so we needed to come up with, together with the partner we're working with, a mechanism to do that. Okay, the other thing, okay, and that is BizTalk has this mechanism to be able to update multiple bits of information directly into a database in parallel. So you could have, at a conceptual level, 500 updates going simultaneously in parallel, running from one database into another. And what that meant in practical terms was that if a user went in and updated a telephone number, say for example in one database, and 5 minutes later they realized that they had regional code was incorrect, and they went and changed it, say from 02 to 03, and then 5 minutes after that, they went and realized, oh no, they didn't need a landline, they wanted a mobile number. What was conceptually possible with this, okay, is that the update for the regional postcode, which is the second change, could hit the database before the first one got there, and then the third one could happen after that. Okay, so there's a mechanism to deal with that in BizTalk called orchestrated correlation. And basically what that means is it enables you to group all changes for a second record together and have them run through sequentially. There is a bit of a payoff in terms of speed, and in practical terms, I think it's down to nanoseconds, okay? Certainly we didn't see it at a user end, but those are one of, I guess, the gotchas in the background. Okay. This is, I guess, something to be aware of, and it was more a philosophy from our side, and that is in CRM, the record updates happen both asynchronously, which basically means there can be a delay. Okay, the standard workflow mechanisms in CRM enable you to update a record, and what that can basically mean is, say, for example, if a person wanted once an appointment was closed, and you wanted to see the last appointment date on a customer card, is that the customer card wouldn't be updated immediately. Okay. It can happen that there'll be a lag, basically, while this asynchronous service runs in the background to update the record. Certainly from our point of view, because we'd worked in ERP systems for so many years, in an ERP system, users get used to instant gratification. They want to have validation. The moment I update something here, if I go to this record, I can see the thing updated immediately. Okay, and from what that basically meant is that a lot of the updates into record we actually didn't do through JavaScript on the front end. We prefer to use plugins in the background. Okay. This is a personal approach, but many people may vary, but what that did provide us with is a mechanism to provide instant updates to records. That was pretty key. The second thing is that there is an asynchronous service that runs in the background. The difficulty with many of these services, they can stop running. And in a CRM context, what that means is that the updates don't go through. If you then start the service, the ones that have failed aren't updated. Okay, so just understanding the technology, I guess, was something and from our point of view, it does take a little longer. But what we found from a robustness point of view is that doing it with a synchronous mechanism meant more programming, but it gave a much more reliable user experience. No, it's more the concept of an asynchronous service. So you can get it to trigger an update, but if you're using an asynchronous mechanism, the update will go through. It's just not instantaneous. You have to do a screen refresh sometimes to do it. And from our point of view, it was a little bit disconcerting to the users. They wanted to see it immediately. Well, yes, it just takes time, and depending on the tools you're using, that there's some background stuff you need to consider. So it does work, but from an experience point of view, it wasn't something we opted for. Some people are quite happy with that, so that's why we opted to do things in a synchronous manner. Okay, and then the last thing is that. In terms of delivering functionality inside a CRM screen, is that you can get a lot of functionality to happen directly on the form using JavaScript. Okay, and certainly what we needed to balance off in our own mind is when to do stuff in JavaScript, because it's a relatively easy mechanism to code, and when to do stuff in a plugin. And a plugin is basically a piece of code that executes when a record gets opened or when it's saved. Okay. Now the interesting thing to appreciate with this is that JavaScript only operates on a form or on a record once that record is opened. Okay. So if you're going to do, say, for example, an import out of something like if you're doing a synchronization from BizTalk, say, for example. And what we wanted to do is you can go and put in a total project value, and you might expect to say, well, how much revenue am I going to get from this total project? And it might be calculated, for argument's sake, at 20%. If you put that logic in at a JavaScript level, and you insert the records, through BizTalk, that calculation won't happen. So it needs to happen in two places. So those are some of the things that it's more background information and the stuff to consider, okay? And I guess, a bit of information for people. Okay, I mentioned earlier it does all work, okay? That bit you can be rest assured that there's no detail on it. What we did find, okay, is that skills really were an absolutely fundamental component of developing consistently and confidently in this particular space. As we said earlier, one of the things we learned is we try to migrate developers into this particular area, and what we found is that it wasn't an easy thing to do, and you had to pay a lot of school fees along the way because they weren't able to do this. So we opted to try and find people that had way more experience or a different, more relevant experience in our particular area, and were able to demonstrably develop code to a particular standard in this particular space. So skills certainly from our side, as well as the partners we worked on, were fairly fundamental. The guys needed to be experienced in CRM, and the second thing, they really needed to be experienced in things like BizTalk and SharePoint. Once we found we had the right caliber of people in there, it all seemed to start happening pretty quickly. We could score runs consistently. The second thing is we really need, and the third thing, I guess, with the skills from a network and infrastructure point of view, is we found often we really need to get to the hardcore tech guys inside the environment to get to the network administrators. What we find, I guess, and this is one of the quirks with working with the network guys in any environment, what I had to tell our guys over and over again is don't go to the, because often there's always sometimes, whenever I go into environment, I don't know what it is, but there seems to be some animosity between an organization and its IT department. There's always some frustration or bad blood going on there, okay? From our point of view, the guys in the network environment are our lifeblood, okay? We can't work without them. And often what I say to our guys, look, it's up to us to figure out a way to work with these guys. And a key thing with this was I said to the guys is that if you're experiencing a problem and you suspect it's in a certain area, don't go to the network guys and expect them to do your homework for you. You've got to arrive, you've got to have the problem well defined, you've got to be indicative, you have to say, these are all the things I've tried. When I do this, this is what happens. Have the groundwork laid. Okay, be able to paint a fairly concise picture as to exactly where it is you've got to and why you need their help. And once we started to do that, what we found is 9 times out of 10, the guys would go, oh yeah, just change that. Okay, and then suddenly life was good. So that was a key takeaway in terms of our, you know, getting our guys to talk, you know, with the network support dudes. The next thing is really needed to get into a fair bit of detail. When I say relating to the detail, if you're finding it hard, a lot of the time, if your skills are right, and you're having difficulty in terms of the development or deployment or anything like that, sometimes there could well be a fair bit of detail missing. So, for example, if you go back to your functional specification, if you're not providing the detail inside there, that may well be the reason you're finding it hard. And even if you are providing the detail, sometimes it isn't clear enough to the people that are doing it. Okay. All right. Then the last thing is really the job of getting the right people. Okay. And this is really a fine balance. Okay. And this is something I really, in hindsight, again, it was one of those things of saying, my goodness, it was staring me in the face. We kind of knew it anyway. But there was a particular personality in this project that really drove home how key the customer project lead is, okay, and how key, I guess, the project lead on the vendor or our side is, okay. And what this is really all about is the right combination of the right-hand side of being able to nurture and assist and cajole people into moving things along, okay. And on the other side of things, having an iron fist and a velvet glove, okay? There were just some times when it was really important, particularly in large organizations, because you've got an IT department, you've got a solution architecture department, you've got a database administration department, and these guys don't always talk, so you know, don't always work together, or there's our little these islands or little empires that are built. All too often we've seen is that projects start to stall because people get distracted, they're not talking to each other. And in this particular instance, what we found with the project lead is that he pretty thick-skinned dude, okay, and he was just prepared to walk in and shake things up. Okay, and sometimes it got down to, you know, doing the, really talking harshly to the guys in terms of being able to move things along. I guess the key thing with this is that this particular individual was prepared to go over people's heads. It was literally anything to get the job done, okay. And it was an absolute win for us because from our point of view, it meant that we never lost momentum in the project, okay. Other key things from a customer lead point of view, and that is having a consistent vision from start to finish in terms of the design of the implementation. So often when we start to take requirements and we go out to the different regional areas and we get requirements from different users, what happens is that people start to say, well, I need this and I need that. And then basically what we need to do is we need to sift all of this stuff out, and we need to be able to decide what is going to be delivered. Now, we don't necessarily say, no, you can't have that, but you have to choose a finite amount of stuff that you can deliver now. Some of the stuff might be released in second or third releases. But what is really important is having a person or persons that are able to consistently say, these are the parameters in which we're working. Part of that is definitely containing the scope of an implementation. And that's, being able to say, look, this is the amount of functionality we're going to deliver around customers. This is the amount of functionality we're going to deliver around leads. This is the amount of functionality we're going to deliver around contact. And in terms of how they integrate, this is the way it's going to work. What they also need to be able to do is they need to be able to take that back to their business and explain, this is why we're doing it, and continually keep their end users informed. And the way that this was done was during the requirements analysis, we had working groups that came up from each of the different regional areas, and we took the requirements from them. Then once we built a prototype, we gave that to them and we showed them how how their requirements being translated to functionality on the screen. When we started to do the development, once we got the development to a point where we had some stuff to show them, like whole processes at a time, we'd get together with each of those regional groups again and show them how it was working. And we got continual feedback from the guys. This works. That doesn't make sense. This needs more clarity. And a lot of the time, the issue wasn't, for the most part, with the functionality that was on the form. What we found out was often just the look and feel. Too many fields on a screen. Okay, a bunch of stuff down the left-hand side that we find confusing. Okay, so that was often the type of stuff that we'd get back. A very little issue often with the functionality, strangely enough. But what that did mean is these guys were having a pleasant experience every time there was an interaction with us and the product, and they were taking that back to their regions. And what we found is that there was a much more pleasant experience when it came to do the training, because these guys were like mavens. They were out there, and they'd done a lot of the selling for us. Okay. What this person also needs to be capable of is having the hard conversations within an organization. Being able to get the right people, and often I'll give you a classic example. We're trying to get this BizTalk stuff to work. We've done all the field mappings. We've done all we've managed to do all the linking through the web services into CRM, but we keep on having these little error messages when we try to do the connections. And eventually, what happened is that this guy kind of just got everyone in the same room, and there was much effing and blinding and a requirement to, explanation of what everyone's responsibilities were, with a very clear, direct message to sort this stuff out. And it very shortly, we had the thing, it was all taken care of. But what it did is a very strong leadership on that side, and able to both manage multiple vendors as well as their own internal organization in terms of setting priorities. I guess one of the key things in terms of the containing of scope, I guess every organization has a... what we did is that we went off to one of the people on the customer side, and I think the guy had a doctorate in IT, and part of what he was looking to do was to map out all the fields between the ERP system and the stuff that needed to go into a CRM together with all the business rules. Okay, and we needed this to happen within all the different products that the guys are using. Okay, and the guy went away for 2 weeks. Okay, and we thought, well, that should be enough time. And when we came back, we thought this would all be neatly laid out. Okay, what he came back with was a white paper. Okay, on how the product hierarchy in CRM could be aligned and used to work with this thing. Nothing to do with the product mapping. Okay. And again, that was one of the things with this vision. Okay, all too often, dudes get out there, they're trying to showcase their talents. Your project needs X, Y, Z, and this guy goes off and delivers this thing. Okay, and it was one of those, WTF moments, you know, what the? it was just this, it's a bit like herding cats, okay? You can't underestimate the importance of this person on the customer lead side. And inevitably what happens in this process is that people's egos do get a bit trampled on and they get their back up because sometimes they don't like being called into line. And what I said to our guys is what's important to realize when a person's doing this is utilize the energy. What was never in any doubt in my mind is what the end game was. And this person was saying, look, keep focused on that. So even if they did kind of trample on us and other people in the project from time to time, is that I said, just focus on the intent. Let's just use the energy. And as a result of that, I mean, that was a really key thing. Okay. From the vendor side, in terms of the lead, okay, in terms of vendor lead, and this is the role that I typically play, is that often what I find ourselves in the field, we try and bring, I guess, our best experience to the table, stuff we've learned, and particularly when it comes to process. So if people are updating things like telephone numbers or email addresses, or we want a particular workflow around the way that leads process through the organization, we'll typically try and bring to the table the way we have found it works best in other organizations. Now, loosely put, I call that design pushback, because often someone will say, well, I think it needs to work this way. And what we'll say, well, what actually happens in real life is that you need to consider this and this and this, okay? And really try and bring a lot of that stuff. So we do have, there is a bit of negotiation in terms of sometimes trying to communicating, I guess, what our experience is showing the best way that for something to be solved in. The second thing, I guess, and this is a lesson more for our developers, and that is often, and the analogy I heard most recently is that, you know, if you go to a car show, okay, and you see a prototype, okay, of a vehicle that's out on the showroom floor, and people would look up to it and they say, man, these guys have really got this. The lines are beautiful, the functionality in the car, that's all whiz bang. 2 years later, you see the same model delivered, and it looks different, okay, and people go, you guys have lost it, okay. And the reason 9 times out of 10 that occurs, okay, is that you've got the engineers will look at this thing and say, well, from a manufacturer, you know, there'll be excuses all the way along the line as to why that didn't occur. Now, the challenge I put back to our developers is that, look, if you look at the way that this works, we want this thing to work. The reason we want it that way is because it makes most sense for the end user experience. The pushback from the developers a lot of the time is they say to us, well, it's just too hard. And I say, well, that's not my problem. Okay, you guys need to develop it in that fashion because it makes the most sense for the end user. Okay, and sure, there was, and strangely enough, is that when the guys get the accolades at the end of it, when people are saying, man, that really works well for us, it makes all that hard input up front work well. So what we try to do is say, we need to solve the problem. How you do it is really, that's what the developer's skill does that. Okay. Sometimes there are practical limitations, and as a result of that, sometimes we do need to compromise. But in this environment, strangely, for the most part, we haven't needed to do that. And then the last thing is we continually try and innovate. You know, we'll look at a workflow, and guys will say, well, I have to do this manually, or I need to collect stuff in a particular way, and we'll try and find some way within the technology to do that. Okay, a philosophy really from our side is to make sure that the users get the best possible experience, and the technology is there to do it. Okay. The key takeaway from this is that the leads take responsibility for the project. There's a famous person that retired recently, and there's an analogy that a conversation that apparently took place with his executives, and it goes something along the lines of this: if you're the janitor in a building and you can't clean a room because the door's locked, you can make an excuse. By the time you get to project lead or director role, excuses don't matter. You've got to make it happen. And a key part of this is both of those roles take responsibility, and they're there to break down the barriers. Okay, the last bit really in terms of the people is our technical staff. Okay, and from our point of view, a key thing with this is that if we found we got guys in that were light in experience or didn't have particular expertise in the areas we're working with versus guys that were well experienced in a particular area. Our experience was in terms of being able to deliver results was quite different. And this also went on subcontractors or vendor side. When it came to skills working in the BizTalk area, when we found we got the right guy in on the job, things suddenly started working easily. You know, literally within the space of a day or two, things started to happen. Okay, as opposed to struggling for weeks with getting no result. Okay, not all developers are born equal. Okay, what we typically do from our side is that it's very seldom that we've been able to go in with junior people and get them to work consistently in this block form. If you're having to deliver something every single week, it's a fairly high-pressure environment, and you need to have there's not a lot of time to learn. And so our focus really was that we went out and we typically try to find people that were senior. There's no sort of golden rule, 5 years, 2 years of the experience that they needed to have. It was more the type of experience that they'd had. Strangely enough, these people are inherently cautious when you do find the right person. And the last thing, someone said, well, why 5 days equal 5 days? Okay. As a courtesy to the developers, what we often find is that the guy said, listen, this bit of work is going to take 5 days. I never went back and sold three. Okay. Because my agreement basically with the guys, if you say it's going to take 5 days, you've got to deliver the stuff in five, and it's got to work. And what we find is that it really worked well. And the really good developers typically would factor in about half a day or a day to be able to make sure that they could develop and do the testing. Okay. The big takeaway in terms of getting the right people, a key thing in all of this is to provide the developers, both on for certainly people on our side as well as people on the project side, make sure we avoided distraction, okay, and that would get them to work on one block of thing at a time. When we went through the hiring of developers, okay, it probably took us maybe 3 months to find two of the correct people, and we got in lots of different guys to come in. And there were really two things I asked them to explain. Okay, what I found is that one is to take any piece of work that they'd done in CRM, any process, converting a lead, say, for example, and explain that in detail to me. And if I find that they had this appreciation of process, we're a long way to being able to get them to do the work. The second thing I got them to do is really explain the specifics in terms of when they use things like JavaScript and when they use plugins and why. And if I found if they could get into that level of detail, then they'd done both. Often we find people had experience in JavaScript but nothing in the plugin side, and that led to a lot of heartache. We did ask at some people for evaluating a piece of their code. I'd go to our developers and I'd say, how do we do that? Because sometimes we just couldn't find the CRM guy, so we'll give us a piece of your best code and we'll do that. A really funny story. One of the guys, there was this humming and ahhing about this, and the next thing we got sent this bit of code, okay, and it was a programming for a lunar roving module, okay, and I said, well, that's really interesting, and this, he was asked to do this by some big company, and I sent this off to one of the developers, and he came back 2 seconds, and he said, no, the dude copied it off the following website. So the first two questions certainly have worked the best for us. Okay. Alrighty. That's me. Any questions? Yeah.
Seeing you've done so much with CRM, have you looked at some of the accelerators that are available now and the productivity gains that you may get? Did you utilize any accelerators?
I think where we've seen the short answer is no, we haven't, and not because that they're no good. It's just that because some of the accelerators have come out either around sales reporting and or event management, and we really haven't done a lot in that particular space. So that's been the reason. Yeah. Is there another question? Yes. Yes, we have. Okay, and certainly we borrowed pieces of that. Okay, people will tell us that. If you have a look at Godot website, you'll see that we've got our methodology overlays almost entirely with SureStep. And when we describe what we do from a development point of view, people say, well, that sounds a lot like Agile. The strange thing was that neither of these were developed from those components. This was stuff we tried to do, and I was just getting to this point, this doesn't work. And as a result of that, and I'd look at our developers, and they were frustrated and unhappy. And the moment I started to line things up in dots, you know, I had this epiphany one day with the Pac-Man thing. And then one of my colleagues said to me, "Well, I heard somewhere those are called sprints, and I think that comes out of the Agile methodology." Yeah. Okay, is that what we'd call them sprints? So we've adopted and called stuff our own, and we really just, this is stuff that works well for us. Yeah. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.